and welcome to Masters of Our Domain, the podcast that was once about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld, but is presently about Spartacus, Blood and Sand. Today we have me, Phoebe, and we also have Dr. Patrick Wyman. How are we?
Oh, living the dream.
Living the dream. We're back to living the dream.
Living the dream. I went with rocking and or rolling earlier, and I feel it's not another day in paradise.
But it's not rocking and or rolling.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to downgrade from rocking and or rolling.
Okay. Well, we're still living the dream, though.
Yeah. No, it's a mild downgrade. They're next to each other on the spectrum of how a father can possibly be doing.
They're adjacent. They're on a continuum.
Exactly.
They're part of the same constellation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. No, I'd say it's going pretty well. It's hot. It's 110 degrees Fahrenheit here, which is
okay. Yeah,
than
that's
it
pretty
be.
Hot.
Yeah.
What's that in real temperatures?
Well above 40.
Well above 40. Okay. That's too hot.
Yeah.
I'm gonna say that.
It's very warm.
I'm gonna get controversial and call that too hot. We don't have Milo today. So if anyone was pressing play on the podcast in a kind of a who will it be today? Which ones will it be? It is the me and Pat configuration. It is the dads configuration, just the dads. We have decided that Milo and I is just the lads. Pat and Milo is just the dudes. Pat and I is just the dads. So if anyone is keeping a note of the different configurations.
I really like this taxonomy, and I think it's extremely accurate. I like where your head has gone with it. I think it's appropriate. I think we keep it.
Yeah. I'm happy with it. I'm going to set this down in stone. Like, because originally we'd written it on some kind of wax tablets.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think this is ready to go to the Masons.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the problem with wax tablets. They just don't preserve.
They don't, no.
There is not, as far as I know, there are not very many surviving examples of wax tablets, which would have been the fundamental writing medium for almost everybody in the ancient world.
Yeah.
Here's a fun wax tablet fact for you. So one that has been recovered has no wax in it, but the wood survives. And so what they've tried to do is use it as a palimpsest because the tip of the stylus would have scratched into the wood. They've tried to recover at least some of the writing on this wax tablet by taking images of the scratchings onto the wood and trying to make it make some sort of sense. Mm-hmm. That's a project for the computers. I don't know how they work or how it works, but I'm told that it's promising.
Wow, that is cool.
We're just a font of facts here about
fact font.
Yeah, fact font. Yeah, that's got a ring to it. I like it.
Yeah, welcome to Fact Font Corner. where we will be saying something which is surprisingly difficult to say, and we will be discussing Spartacus, Blood and Sand, episode 12, Revelations. So it's kind of hotting up. Stuff's happening.
Yeah,
we are
nearing the denouement.
We are nearing the denouement. We are in the penultimate zone, which is like the last bit, but you know, everyone's got a pen.
We have entered the cool zone. I think
we've
it's fair to say
we've entered the cool zone, and we've developed this really fun mode of storytelling where sort of like stuff has happened in the last couple of episodes, but like also not really. So what we've got in this episode, and I actually really like it. It's very, very 2010s as a way of narrativizing. It's how I would describe it is like a kind of is a like a God's chess game where all the pieces have been kind of scattered around, but finally the pieces are being lined up and we can see them being lined up and we can see what I like to think of as screenwriter gods with like little figurines that represent all the characters being like, and we have to put this one here and this one here and this one here. And then next episode it is time for the big quake. And then you shake the shake the board and all the pieces. And we haven't really had that so far. And it's like, and it's such like a staple of like TV series from like 15, 20 years ago. And we don't really do that anymore because for one thing, because we've got the fucking bullshit thing that we do in TV shows now where the denouement is in the penultimate episode.
Thank you, Game of Thrones.
And then you've got the stupid epilogue episode. I hate it.
Game of Thrones ruined that. And because that was the Game of Thrones formula was you put the biggest thing in the second to last episode of the season. And now every prestige TV series since Game of Thrones has done that. So since 2011, basically, this is one of the last shows that didn't have Game of Thrones as a model for how to do that kind of TV storytelling, which means that in this series, we get an actual fucking conclusion.
Yeah, which is really fun. And in fact, this was something that I found really confusing when we were doing Barbarians, because the big fight in the forest is the last episode. And I was like, oh, is this allowed still?
Yeah.
Are we allowed to put the climax in the last episode where it fucking belongs?
So I the reason I love it from a structural perspective is I think that every season of a TV show should be able to stand on its own as a coherent work.
Agreed.
And you should treat the end of every season of a TV show as if it is the ending as a whole. You should be able to say this has wrapped up the story. And because otherwise you're just doing a 30-hour long movie, which I'm sorry, I think that's, if you want to make a movie, make a movie. If you want to make a TV series, lean into the things that actually make a TV series special format wise. And the ability to do a bajillion different plots and have them all come together to be more than the sum of their parts while telling a coherent story is, to me, the heart of what makes TV worth doing as a medium. So this is something, now that we're reaching the end of this season, I feel like for all of the many, many silly, unfortunate things about this TV series, from a structural perspective, they've actually nailed this. Mm-hmm. So all of the pieces, all of the subplots, all of the A, B, C, D, E, like there are so many subplots in this show that we've seen over the course of these 12 episodes now that we finished today's, that are all slotting into place in the way that they should for the finale. That is good writing. That is structurally good.
And this is what I mean about it being like God's chess game. Like, look at everyone lining up and we're going to make them fight. It's like Warhammer, but we're people. As is my understanding, I'm not actually 1,000% clear on what Warhammer is.
Oh my God. Okay. I could tell you anything you want to know about Warhammer. I love it so fucking much.
I know someone who's like super into it. And I said, so what, you paint your little toys and then you make them fight? And he got really annoyed and wouldn't tell me any more information.
In fairness, that is an accurate description of what Warhammer is.
Yeah, I thought so.
It is accurate. I have figures in my office right now.
No,
I don't make them fight because I have the Total War Warhammer game. So for my computer, so I don't need to make them fight. I can make the computer do it for me.
The computer does that for you.
The computer does it for me.
That's much cooler.
We all know it's not cool, Phoebe. It's not good. So I don't have to make them fight. I do like painting them and looking at them though.
Okay, that's fair enough.
And also my kids really like doing it. They really like using the plastic glue and they like doing the painting. They like mixing the colors. So it's a fun little activity for us.
Yeah, I feel like you're hiding behind your children here a little bit.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah, because these are not children's toys. They are expensive. And like I made 10 orcs with my son. And I then basically gave them to him because we didn't paint them very well. This was my first real run at painting miniatures. They didn't turn out great, but I gave them to him and now they are all destroyed. And it's not like he was banging them off each other. It's just like, these are not actual toys that you can play with, which is really unfortunate. So they do Warhammer figurines stand up to the attentions of an 8-year-old? The answer is no, they do not. But yeah, I could talk about Warhammer for hours.
Okay. Well, tell you what, we could, when we have some time, we could record some bonus material where you can talk about Warhammer. How about that?
Yeah. Do you want to know the lore? Because I know all of the lore.
I don't know. Do I?
The answer is probably not. No. I wouldn't recommend it.
I feel like I might have seen, was there a Warhammer film?
No. Uh-uh.
So what did I watch then? What was
you
that?
You might have watched a trailer where they do some short animations, but there's
No. This was a full length film. It had a big green guy in it.
No, Are you the Incredible Hulk?
No, he was an orc of some description, but
that Warcraft. Warcraft. That's a much different thing. And never the twain shall meet. And any Warhammer fan is going to be insulted that you compared it to Warcraft. Sorry. Just saying.
Well, I quite enjoyed this film. It had a big green guy, and there was a green baby who had tiny little orc tusks.
Yeah,
that was kind of cute.
Yeah, I did see this movie.
There was like a bad magician or maybe a good magician. I don't know.
You know who directed that movie? David Bowie's son.
Really?
Yeah, Duncan Jones.
Huh. There you go. I was trying to make a point about the self-contained TV series, but it's
like lining up all your Warhammer figures
and making them fight. What I was thinking of specifically, there's absolutely no reason why you would have done, but did this show called This Life ever make it to the States?
It's not ringing any bells for me.
It was a sort of comedy drama from the late 90s, which was about this group of young lawyers and like their kind of, you know, the life and times of these young lawyers, and they have relationships with each other and they have affairs and a bit about
lawyer
their workplaces
things.
But you know that this stuff it's very, very good. This Life, it had early performances from Jack Davenport, who plays the commandant in fucking Pirates of the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
It's got Andrew Lincoln in. It's like one of his first parts. It's got Daniela Nardini. He might have seen in other stuff. It was a really good show, and it had this kind of fun cliffhanger ending where the central couple, the woman in the central couple, has been having an affair with her boss, and her boyfriend finds out about it. And the final scene is her like punching the woman who tells her boyfriend about it in the face, and then it turns into this like massive like kind of fray. And at the time, all of the cast thought that there was going to be another series. And they were absolutely filming this scene with the understanding that, you know, we would find out what happens after this punch. And then they were all told afterwards that the channel had cancelled it. It would not be commissioning another series. It's like, it's a kind of, unlike, this is so minor as well, it's such a kind of minor thing for it to be. On British TV, this is like a kind of famous standalone TV series. They never made another one. They did a kind of a This Life in 20 Years kind of reunion show, which was terrible and nobody liked, and everyone just pretends it just didn't exist. But they didn't kind of capitulate, and they didn't do any further episodes. And it works really well that you don't find out, because any kind of TV series, and I include any kind of historical drama in this as well, needs to function in that gap between artificiality and immersion. You need to be reminded that as soon as you stop watching it, these characters die. They're no longer, they don't carry on existing outside the boundaries of the narrative. This is why I think there's this general creative problem with the whole concept of the fic. I think trying to make characters live on outside of the boundaries of the narrative, I think that's a failure of imagination. There's nothing wrong with it as a hobby, but like I don't think it's a good thing to kind of like to like aim towards. Like, you can do what you want with the material that's there, not what the material that you want to be there.
You're describing fan fiction brain.
Yeah, that's what I'm describing. I've already offended the Warhammer people. Now I'm offending the fan fiction people. I don't have anything to say for myself on this front.
No, I mean, I think there, I like where your head's at, because I think we're allergic to the idea of real endings. Like, as somehow as a society, and I think, I don't know whether like the Marvel universe and Star Wars and all of that shit is a symptom of the problem or whether it actively contributes to it. But the idea that the characters just go on and on and on and on and on, right? That you can dip in and find them in whatever context at whatever time, that there is always a story that involves that character waiting to be told. Come up with some new characters.
Come up with some new characters.
Come up with some new people. Like, I'm a big fan of storytelling as coherence, as an attempt to provide order to a messy world and make sense of things and really highlight some themes and just ongoing continuity in which there are no real stakes because we know that the characters are going to show back up again. I don't like it. It bothers me on a basic level. And to your point about the lining up the pieces, that's the essence of what good TV writing is. And it's why TV writing, in my opinion, is the hardest genre of writing to nail. I'm dead serious about this. I think it's harder than writing a novel. I think it's harder than writing a screenplay for a movie. I think it's harder than writing nonfiction of any kind, and all of which I've taken a stab at writing at some point. I think TV writing is the hardest because you're working under really set limitations for time. Mm-hmm. So you have to be ruthlessly efficient with how you prioritize plots, with how you put them together, with what you decide to cut, with how you shoot and edit. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff has to be on fucking point to make even a mediocre show. You have to work really, really hard to make that stuff work. And when it all comes together fluidly and seamlessly, you're watching the equivalent of a miracle. So my mother-in-law worked on Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. And she has worked on a whole bunch of movies and TV series over the years. And what she told me is that even making a mediocre show is a miracle, that there are so many moving pieces that go into making TV, that anybody doing anything less than an outstanding job is visible in the final product. And making something that actually hangs together, that's really good, is almost impossible. And so this show is not perfect. Right, like blood, Spartacus, think, blood and sand. I think we can all admit is far from perfect.
There are some flaws,
but I think structurally it is extremely sound.
Okay,
because the plot lines that look extraneous early on, as we get to the end, we discover they're not actually extraneous. They're going to play a role in explaining how everybody has gotten to this point where rebellion is not only thinkable but desirable.
Yeah.
And to have all of those pieces come together, all of these different characters become have their subplots turn toward the main thing that we always knew coming, but we didn't know how we were going to get there. Like, that's not an easy trick to pull off. And whatever the shortcomings of the acting, the set design, the limitations of the late 2000s, early 2010s aesthetic. There are many limitations to all of this. The actual structure of it that those things are working in works. Yep. And I think that's why the show works, because there's also a consonance between the themes and the structure, the way they come together. Like, the themes that they have in an episode, when they pile up these storylines, the themes work together really well. So it's not just that they're choosing random storylines and shoving them together to move you along chronologically. It's that each individual episode, the themes reinforce one another.
Yeah.
So
I do agree with that. A lot of the, shall we say, aesthetic flaws of the show are a little bit distracting in that regard.
Yes, extremely.
But when you remember that nobody knows how to structure a TV show anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I do think the epilogue episode is a really, really big, I think it's a really big part of that, because it's like, it's a total undermining of the structure.
It's a cop out. It's a cop out.
Yeah.
And when you give yourself, as a writer, you know this, I know this, when you give yourself that leeway, when you give yourself that amount of space on the leash, so to speak, you get lazy with it. It's easier to get lazy with it. It's harder to be ruthless in the ways that you know you need to be ruthless to tell a coherent story. Like, you know, the whole like kill your darlings thing, right, is overblown as writing advice goes, but there's truth to it in the sense that you've got to be fucking brutal in your self-analysis if you want to make something that is actually good. You have to be willing to get rid of pieces that you like or that might be meaningful to you that do not serve the overall story.
Yeah.
And the epilogue episode is a venue to not do that. Right. Like that's, I think I'm 100% in agreement with you. I'm so glad you mentioned that, because you've hit on a pet peeve that I could not articulate for years and years and years and years and years.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad we're in agreement, because I fucking hate the epilogue episode.
It's bullshit.
So we know that sooner or later Spartacus is going to say, you know what? I've had enough. I've had enough of this. I've had enough of you. Had enough of you. Had enough of you. Had enough of you. This is bullshit. I'm not having this anymore. I'm not having this anymore. Fine. Put me into slavery. Force me to fight to the death in front of a bunch of you know, sort of baying aristocrats. Fine. Also put my wife into slavery. Kill my wife. Make me kill my best friend. No, I'll put up with that. But you know what? Sooner or later, a man's got a line. And this, for some reason, is mine. So what seems to be the issue is not that his wife has been killed, but that his wife has been killed by his master. But something fun that happens in this episode, which ties into a question I asked you a few episodes ago, which is, what do slaves call their masters and mistresses behind their back? And it changes in this episode. They stop calling Batiatus and Lucretia Dominus and Domina, and they start referring to them by their names, which I'm very excited by.
Yeah, and that has to be intentional.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, it must be. Otherwise, it's a really weird choice.
Yeah, I'm 100% sure that's intentional, because it's showing us that as Batiatus's reach exceeds his grasp, as he starts taking bigger and bigger risks and brutalizing his the slaves of his household more and more and more and more, in order to reach that point, he is breaking down the walls of authority and the bonds that go beyond raw force that keep those people in place.
Yeah,
that we've talked about this over and over again, that slavery functions as a system of domination, not just through the actual application of violence, which does matter, which is important, but through the threat, the fear, and affective bonds that supplement the ties of violence, that supplement the exemplary violence of a slave system. And Batiatus, we are watching him make the fundamental mistake that slave owners of all periods have made, is when they fall back solely on violence, when they neglect the other unspoken pieces of the bonds that tie people lower down the hierarchy into place. The hierarchy collapses because it's not based solely on violence, right? Yeah. And so I just finished reading an absolutely fascinating book on the Atlantic slave trade. It's called The Slave Ship, A Human History.
Oh, yeah. We were talking about this last episode, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By Marcus Rediker. It's a fascinating book, but it's all about the slave ship as the site in which these processes happen, and how different people experience the slave ship. So obviously the enslaved captives who were being transported for sale, but also the crew, the captain. And one of the points that Rediker makes in this is how this system desensitizes everybody to violence and makes everybody worse, right? Like that the captain becomes a tyrant, The captain brutalizes not only the enslaved people, but also his own subordinates. That the sailors brutalize the enslaved people. They brutalize each other. They pick on unfortunate members of the crew, because the violence of it winds its way into the basic social mores and social interactions that define this space. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I love about this show is that we see that dynamic so clearly, that the basic logic of slavery leads people to behave in terrible ways, in morally unacceptable ways, because they tell themselves that this is how the system works, what they have to do, that the system is worth maintaining. And so it's okay to do these things in service of that goal.
Sure.
And in this episode, we finally see the people who are most bought into the system among the enslaved. So Crixus and the Doctore, we finally see their doubts, right? We now know what Crixus's breaking point is. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to see what the Doctores is.
Oh, we see it explicitly when he finds out what happened to Barca, right?
What happened to Barca? Yeah, that these people, Crixus was not bound to the house of Batiatis by the threat of violence. Sure, like there was violence in his world. That was probably part of what reconciled him to his position in the first place. But by and large, what makes Crixus stay is the promises is loyalty to the institution, loyalty to his master, and desire for the rewards that accrue to him through his performance of his place in that system, right? And in this episode, we are now finally seeing what happens when those effective bonds break down. Same deal with the Doctore, that he is there out of loyalty. He's there because he believes in the institution of the House of Batiatis. Mm-hmm. But that deal goes both ways, right? That there are implicit promises being made by the master to keep those people in place. It's not just, if you don't do this, you'll be hurt. And watching Batiatis and Lucretia violate those is ultimately what's going to lead us to rebellion.
Yeah. Like it's, like, I think it does a pretty good point I think it does a pretty good job of making the point that a person owning society is rotten at its very foundations. There's no way of it becoming moral because its roots are diseased.
Yep.
And that a lot of the kind of continuation of said society relies on everyone agreeing to participate in the pretense that the oppressors are many and the oppressed are few, as opposed to the other way around, which is, of course, any kind of slave rebellion or any kind of rebellion of the oppressed is like a crack in that illusion. And that's why said rebellions have to be so violently suppressed, not just to reseal the crack, but to prevent people in the future from remembering that they are many and the oppressors are few. Mm-hmm. So I think the show does a pretty good job of making these observations. And I think that it making these observations around the gratuitous graphic sex and violence and the completely laughable script and delivery, I can't decide whether that makes it more annoying that it does a pretty good job of making this like quite sophisticated point, or whether it means that it's technically one of the best shows ever made. Which is it? Because it's one of them.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's one of them.
That's why I love this show, is because it exists in that space where you can't tell whether you should be annoyed that this is the task that the people who put this together, who have done a great job, right? I think we're mostly in agreement that the way that they put this show together is pretty good, that either their fine work is being spoiled by a cast that is not the strongest that's ever been put together. I think that's safe to say. Some pretty unfortunate dialogue, pretty unfortunate aesthetic choices, or is that part of the deal that they wanted to show you that you could make something that is actually wildly appropriate and interesting, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but I'm fascinated by it. And that's why I keep coming back to this show.
It's like hiding the medicine in the dog food. Like I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to.
Which is the exact opposite of 300. The exact opposite. Where they want you to believe that you are imbibing something good, that you're imbibing some big points about freedom and self-determination and like that there's something there. In reality, we know, having watched 300 and talked about it at length, there is nothing there. There is no there in 300.
There is no
coherent, much less interesting moral heart to that movie.
No, there really isn't.
And this show, for all of its many, many flaws, really does believe in the points that it's making about the nature of this world. And that's so fucked up. I don't know what to do with that.
I don't know what to do with either. Like the big thing about 300 is that it's a very, very stylized surprise. So, and I say surprise because it's not something that you would necessarily to expect to see several millennia hence, but it is a very stylized surprise defense of the helotry system. Mm-hmm. That's what 300 is. 300 is basically just being like, yeah, but what if these people really were superior? What if that literally was just 300 of them? No other people, excuse me.
Several thousand thespians who were there.
who are these like thousands of men that no, we don't have to worry about them. They're wearing normal clothes. They don't have their little weird kind of Spartan knickers on.
I mean, I think, like, funnily enough, to come back to 300 real quick,
let's circle back. We're coming back to 300. We're doing it again.
You can diagnose most of the malaise that has swept through the worldwide special forces community because of 300. It's literally that. It's that they watched this movie or variations on it and thought that they were Spartans. And they have used that kind of self-understanding as really core to who they are. For 20 years now, I don't think you can overstate how damaging 300 as a movie has been to military culture worldwide.
And that's a shame, because everyone knows that on this show we're very pro-military culture.
Yeah, I mean,
we love it. I love a bit of military culture.
It's the things. There are better and worse versions of military cultures. Like, military cultures are always going to exist.
Militarized neocolonialism. I love that shit. Yeah.
But some military cultures are more toxic than others. Even within one nation's military, not all military cultures are as bad. And I think part of the reason why special forces culture worldwide, but especially in the United States, has gotten so bad is because of they've imbibed this like imaginary warrior ethos from media like 300.
And it's because they think they found something from the ancient world where they're just like, okay, this is definitely not gay.
Yeah.
It super is, but
it's
like
super gay.
It's not as gay as like poetry or boat building or the Delian League, which was a club in ancient Athens as a gay club.
Yeah. My favorite meme. Kylie played there, Jesus Christ. that was good. That was really good. My favorite meme is one that says there are two Greeks inside you. One is Athenian. One is Spartan. Both are gay. And just true. Just objectively true. They just did like dudes. And that's, look, if you can't deal with the reality of the ancient world, how it actually was,
then you shouldn't be fucking it.
You absolutely shouldn't be fucking it. But like, then you're not dealing with history. You're dealing with myth or legend or like kind of comforting ideas that make you feel good. You're not dealing with the reality of history. Like, if you want to idolize the Roman world, as a great many people on the political right seem to right now, then you need to not just admit that slavery was there or even that slavery was bad. You need to understand the precise ways in which that whole world was built on the mass exploitation of enslaved people.
Yeah.
And like, if you like that world and you want to say that it was a good world, then you need to, then you probably need to say that that was good too, because they don't exist without each other.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, I think there are quite a lot of people who would probably just say that it's good. So it's not a lot you can say in that regard.
I mean, I at least want them to own it.
Yeah. Like, okay. Fair enough.
That's the, I think that's a, like, okay, you want to make that argument? That's fine. I'm going to engage with the fullness of that argument.
Yeah. Okay. Like, all right. The, I think that's a very generous way of looking at it.
Yeah. Oh, I don't think I have a lot of gifts, but one I do have is to take people at their word and believe them when they make an argument. Oh. I'm like, okay, you want to make that case, I will take you seriously. I will engage with you on those terms, but you'd better own it. Like, you'd better be sure. You're no weaseling, no getting out of it. Like, you want to talk about maybe the South was right in the Civil War? Okay. All right. You want to go down that? Then let's talk about the Cornerstone speech. Let's talk about slavery. Let's talk about all of those things. If you still want to make that argument, then great. Okay. We're not going to agree, but I want you to understand the implications of what you're saying.
I think that is, like I said, I think that's a very generous way of approaching the world. I don't do that. I'm just like, yeah.
But the key to that is that I don't get in many arguments.
Yeah.
Because most of the time I recognize that it's not worth it, that they aren't going to engage on that level, and that they're doing some kind of fantasy thing.
Yeah, fair that's enough. They're doing kind of spot, like kind of spot a cosplay.
Yeah, they're doing or America or antebellum plantation society American South cosplay.
Any kind of cosplay. You know what? I'm going to go 3 for 3 on like insulting sections of the audience. Any kind of cosplay is not great. Let's be honest here.
I don't hate it.
You know what? I always think it looks really fun. And also, like, whenever you see people who do like kind of, who are like properly into cosplay, and you're like, you are so creative in your fancy dress. This is such fascinating art, and I don't understand why you clearly a brilliant genius artist is only using it to go and stand in an airless room with a lot of nerds.
Yeah. I have questions.
Yeah.
That stuff doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but I appreciate the impulse if it comes from joy. Like,
let people have their joy with their fan fiction and their Warhammer and their fairy costumes.
Okay, so I want to draw a distinction between cosplay and reenacting.
Oh yeah, no. I actually do know quite a lot about this now, because last week on 10K we had November on to talk about LARPing, mm-hmm. and I was really interested in like how much hostility there is between like the reenactors and the LARPers and the cosplayers, mm-hmm. and they're all like kind of yeah, but like I don't do that. I'm not doing that.
It's fucking crazy.
That's for losers.
I love this. I love that. First of all, I love that these people exist. But I think the reenacting community, you get a lot of people who are telling on themselves in some way. Mm-hmm. Not all of them. This is not a blanket statement, but I knew a guy who got very into reenacting World War II. On the German side.
Yeah, always. And, it's always, yeah. always, always.
And I'm like, oh, that's a pretty decent proxy marker for where the rest of your head is at. I would say the fact that he immediately bought 2 very large German shepherds after that was also an indicator of where he was going.
I feel bad for Alsatians. They're nice dogs. And I think there's a problem just in general with the black and tan colorway for a dog.
Yeah.
That like
did you refer to it as a colorway as if it was a sneaker drop? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, all right. Okay. Just wanted to check
for the issue, for the limited edition, mm-hmm. Of these kinds of dogs. Whenever you see a black and like a black dog with tan accents, like your first thought is, like, that's a Nazi dog.
Yeah, it's a racist. Dog's racist.
That's a racist dog.
Yeah.
Like. And even if they're like the nicest dogs in the world, if they come in that colorway, I'm going to assume that that dog is a racist.
Yeah.
And maybe that's me being racist against the dog.
No,
I'm judging the dog by the color of its fur.
Look, I've known many racist dogs in my day. So this is a whole thing in the United States, because you want to talk about the demographics of people who do yard work, lawn care. Mm-hmm. In the United States suburbs, it is overwhelmingly Latinos. In the Southwest, where I've lived for most of the past 20 years, if you look at who is doing yard work in these places, it is overwhelmingly people of Mexican descent. That's just the demographic reality of that industry. Now, dogs, which generally do not appreciate people coming into their yard, have picked up on that, right? Mm-hmm. The dogs themselves have ethnic and racial stereotypes, I think in large part because they have identified this particular group of people as people who come into their yard. Mm-hmm. So I have known many racist dogs that only bark at Latinos.
Oh my God.
It's a real thing. It's a real thing. I've got a lot of feelings about it, but it is real. And even if they're not coming into the yard, they see somebody who meets that description and they just immediately start barking. And over whether that's because they smell of yard work or it's an appearance thing, it really does exist. It really does happen.
Have you ever tried approaching any of these dogs and asking them how they feel about the imagined violence of the suburbs?
I haven't gotten a lot of dialogue. I haven't gotten a lot of engagement out of that line of reasoning.
That's the problem with dogs. They absolutely refuse to engage with argument.
Yeah, refuse to check their privilege too. I mean, that's a huge piece of it.
Like absolute steadfast refusal. Like they won't engage with the argument. They won't engage with the argument either on the terms that they have set out. Mm-hmm. They just go woof woof.
Yeah, all of them NIMBYs too. All of them NIMBYs. Very much against the expansion of the housing stock. Frankly, they could stand to do some inner work.
Yeah. All dogs should go to therapy.
Yeah, absolutely.
All dogs should be decolonizing. That's my position. And that is the position by extension of this show.
Yeah. You want to talk about creatures that are institutionalized in the master's world. Oof.
Woof.
Woof. Oh shit. Oh, that was good. I like that. This was an interesting episode because it's mostly table setting for the finale.
It's table setting for everyone to get the big kind of, you know, to flick over one of the pieces. He's like a little Sabutio guy, so he jumps right back up. But then that's gonna flick over all the other pieces. What I am going to do is I'm going to just really, really quickly just read the episode summary.
Yeah, give us a synopsis
Just because for the first time, quite a lot of stuff has happened. So I think it is important to just say what happens, okay? All right, so in the arena, Crixus continues his winning streak and Spartacus kills the condemned Solonius. Now, this is the person who I thought was the magistrate but is not the magistrate. So there's this very grim scene right at the start where it's actually like he's pretty cool in facing his doom. He says to Batiatus, like, all right, you know, I underestimated you, Batiatus, like, fair play. You've really fucked me over here. So fair play to you, man. And Batiatus says something really cool, which is just like, oh yeah, like loads of people underestimate me and I've killed them all. So I'm assuming that we're going to find out some more about that at some point, but that point is not now. Anyway, so Solonius goes out. Spartacus kills him quite horribly. This is one of the nastier deaths that we've had so far. But he does this, you know, kind of for the edification of the magistrate's widow and for the son, who is at any point during this show is somewhere between 7 and 25 years old. It's completely unclear how old he is meant to be. Spartacus plots vengeance, but is warned by his pal, the girly, the slave girl whose name I've forgotten. Mira. Okay, thank you. The one who, and I know that this is supposed to be like deliberate that she looks a ton like the actress who plays his wife. But it's also does make it a little bit confusing because she just really, really looks like the actress who plays his wife. So whenever she shows up, I'm like, oh, he's hallucinating his wife again. No, she's not.
We have already discussed our white people face blindness in the context of this show.
Yeah, but I think it's deliberate that she looks exactly fucking like.
Yeah, right? Yeah. But it like enhances the existing problem for most of us.
It's not helping. It's not helping me. It's not helping either of us. So she warns him that any attack on the master risks the life of all the slaves. And Spartacus, because despite the fact he is portrayed as being the best fighter, the nicest guy around, and also incredibly smart and strategic, for some reason, this has not occurred to him that an attack on the master will come back nastily on the slaves. For some reason, this is not something which he has thought, you know what? That's a good point. That's a good point she's made.
Though I will say, to be fair, we have seen Spartacus do stupid shit at multiple points earlier on. Like, remember his plan to try to get out with his wife? That wasn't exactly a great plan either.
No, that's true. That's true. But still, like, it doesn't take kind of advanced logician to come up with the conclusion that Mira comes up with. Anyway.
Yeah.
But he does stay his hand, but then he notices that Varro's widow, Aurelia, is now working off her husband's debt as a house slave. So that's not ideal. He's not very happy about that. He says, you know, I made sure that she was to be provided for and taken care of. So that's presumably going to come up again. So the ludus later awaits the arrival of Alethea and Glaber. And Batiatus ends up being irked by Glaber's bluntness, but also surprised by Lucretia's pregnancy. This is something that I actually wanted to ask you. How does Lucretia know that she's pregnant?
So I assume that, so she kind of falls faint, right? When she's trying to get down with Crixus.
Yeah.
And so I assume that the matronly woman who's present in that next scene is some kind of midwife or doula.
Okay.
And that she has informed Lucretia that what's happening here is a pregnancy.
If you were pregnant in the ancient world, mm-hmm. was it just that you stopped having periods? Was there any other way of telling?
The other symptoms of pregnancy that start early.
But what if you don't have any symptoms? Some people don't have any symptoms.
Yeah. I mean, I think at that point you're kind of.
You just find out.
Yeah, and I mean, that's why, I think that's part of why in most pre-modern cultures, the quickening is really the...
That's when you find out, yeah.
Yeah, is really considered to be the marker of the beginning of a pregnancy mm-hmm. in the ancient world, in the medieval world, that, like, until you feel the baby move, it's not really a baby. And so but honestly, I don't know all that much about ancient conceptions of pregnancy. That is a blank area for me. Yeah, I would like to know more.
I would like to know more as well. But he's surprised by Lucretia's pregnancy. Presumably, Batiatus is not the father of said baby. Presumably, it's Crixus.
Gotta be Crixus.
Look at him. Look at it. There's no way that man's not fertile. That's certainly what we're led to believe. So I've got a problem. And my problem is, yet again, with Alethea. Mm-hmm. So Glaber, who is the legatus and is also in the process of running for praetor, I believe. So he's a big cheese. He's a big deal. This is why, and I know that the whole point is that everyone in this show is being subtly undermined, whether with the threat of physical violence or the structures that constrain them or the kind of the quiet soft power violence of kind of intrasocial sneering and looking down upon. Whether or not you can really put these in the same category is, I think, arguable, but the point is that Lucretia feels looked down upon by Alethea. Alethea feels looked down upon by Licinia, etc. I think that they couldn't quite decide, basically up until this point, just how elevated in Roman society Alethea really is supposed to be, because they change it basically in every scene that she's in. And I think she's sort of like a cipher character. So she like, she's a wild card. She like, she stands in for whatever she needs to stand in for within the scene. And it does make her extremely inconsistent and extremely incoherent, because if she's, yeah, she's the wife of the legate, she's the wife of the man who is going to be praetor, why is she getting so rattled by Licinia that she fucking stoves her head in? I know Licinia is like, is the cousin of Crassus, and big, like, yeah, big deal. She's, you know, she's one of the family of Crassus, but like, they're roughly of a piece. They're definitely not she's feeling like kind of, in, you know, sort of inferior within that social situation. She might feel like slightly undermined, but definitely not stove her head in undermined.
So I'm very much in agreement. And I think that the way that this show uses Alethea is one of the most, I don't want to say problematic things about it, but distasteful. Mm. I think using the character of the flighty, inconsistent woman as a stand-in for the arbitrary, capricious nature of Roman society and Roman enslavement, especially, I think elides some of what's going on. I think it lessens the punch.
It's suboptimal, isn't it? It's suboptimal.
I think it lessens the punch that goes along with it. I like it in the sense that we do need to know that women, that what matters here is not just gender, but power, and that women like Lucretia and Alethea and Licinia, that they might be oppressed in one regard because of their gender, but they are nevertheless capable of wielding tremendous power over the lives of these people.
And they trade in this soft power. But my whole point is that in soft power terms, the reason that Alethea's downfall is so like is so potent is because Lucretia has turned the tables on her in a way that she never imagined was possible, much in the way that masters do not imagine that slave rebellions are ever going to be possible, because how can they envisage such a turning of the tables? How can they envisage such a reversal of fortune? So it's never occurred to Alethea that Lucretia and Batiatus could really, really fuck her, which is why it doesn't make any sense at all that she is sufficiently brittle and hyper aware of her position that Licinia laughing at her would cause her to have the kind of the Hulk super strength red mist. It doesn't, like, I understand that she has to do something which gives Lucretia and Batiatus power over her, but it being that doesn't make sense, because the only way that this really quite fun scene that we have works is if she never imagines that her position was anything other than ultra elevated. Because if she gets rattled enough by Licinia laughing at her that she stoves her head in, that means that that she imagines her position to be precarious. She would only not imagine her position to be precarious if it didn't occur to her to make sure that Lucretia and Batiatus couldn't fuck. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. I'd like to introduce another possibility.
Yeah.
She's a moron.
Fine.
And she's
definitely supposed to be a moron, but I still think that in the episode where she kills Licinia, I think that the writers briefly forgot. I think they just didn't have like her character pack with them that day. Mm-hmm. So they were just like, okay, so Alethea is this like kind of, she's a kind of slight sort of social climber type. She wants to fuck a gladiator. And the person who was in charge of knowing that she is married to the legate was off sick that day, and was just like, anyone who might have said, she's actually like really like high up.
She's from a senatorial family. That's made clear to us from the very beginning.
Yeah, this would not rattle her. She would not be brittle in the way that Lucretia would, which makes me think that they possibly originally wrote this scene for Lucretia and then thought, oh well, that doesn't make any sense. At least then this can then come back on Alethea in the future. And it is very, very good. So what happens is Glaber is all like, yeah, okay, let's leave the looters with these awful, vulgar people who want to go into politics. How funny. No, of course I won't be endorsing you. And so Batiatus and Lucretia, who are schemey guys, they're schemey and extremely evil now. They're having gone from being like just like dickheads, they're now like, super evil. And that's great.
Villains.
Proper villains. And they've got Licinia's hand in a box, which they show to Glaber, and they're like, yeah, so you are going to be endorsing us. Otherwise, we're going to tell everyone that your wife killed Crassus's cousin. And instead of being like, that's just a hand in a box. You run a gladiator school. You have access to a lot of corpses. That could be anyone. Prove that that is Licinia and prove that my wife killed her. He doesn't say that. He goes, you know what? That tracks. That sounds like something my wife would do. Okay, yeah. She's staying here. I'm going back to Rome. Fine, I'll endorse you. Fuck you. So Lithia is now stuck there. It doesn't make any sense that he isn't like, well, that's just a hand.
Yeah, you got to wonder if...
You got to wonder if she's maybe done this before, if he's just like, oh, fucking hell, not again.
Again with the killing?
What, you're stoving people's head again? Why are you so strong? Look at the size of you. I can't believe you're strong enough to do that.
I know. It's a lot to take in. I wonder if there was additional dialogue in the Licinia scene that got cut, or additional shots that didn't make it in. Or like if like there was supposed to be another line or two there that would have made the way that she snaps in that moment make more sense. Like there had to have been, I wonder if there was something else there in a different draft that didn't make it into the final cut.
Or maybe some kind of backstory or something that would make it make sense. But because the fact that it never occurs to her that Lucretia and Batiatus would be keeping some kind of contingency to use against her means that she would not imagine herself to be sufficiently precarious in her social position that it matters whether or not Licinia is laughing at her. That's all I'm saying.
It doesn't hit the same. Like, this is where the thematic consonance, like the reinforcing of the themes, the way that you stack them up in episodes doesn't always work. Like, because these are the same themes, right? It's who's in charge, who gets to flip the hierarchy, who actually is wielding power. They're doing that stuff at multiple levels through multiple storylines in this episode. Mm-hmm. But I think you're 100% right to note that it's discordant. It doesn't necessarily work because they aren't the same kind of structures of power and control. Like the slave system is categorically different from the social relations that govern how free people interact with each other, free citizens. I think you're right to point that out. That's a really good point, Phoebe.
Thank you. Thanks, Pat. Cheers. Okay, so meanwhile, Spartacus fights against Glaber's soldiers because Glaber's like, you know what? I'm fucking sick of this guy. Like, he has to fight against my soldiers with practice swords. And despite the fact that Spartacus started like not being especially good, he's now like fucking great. So like, he's a credit to the Doctori. You've got to say that. Can't deny that he's a credit to the Doctori. So he kills all of Glaber's soldiers. But meanwhile, Asher has this whole plan that he's going to expose Crixus and Navia's relationship. And he does this quite fiendishly. And Crixus loses the head totally. And he reveals himself, really, a bit like, anyway, this happens. So Crixus gets flogged. Navia gets sold. Before Navia, like, there's this, like, scene which I've complained about this before, and I understand the point of it, but it is just like a particular kind of woman at a Turkish holiday resort who's absolutely insisting that the 20-year-old waiter really does love her. So Lucretia's like, oh, what? So Crixus, you never loved me? And you're like, of course not. Come on. Own him. Like, what's he going to say? Like, no... Mistress, I don't love you. Are you stupid, Lucretia?
So you and I know this. We know this. As viewers, as inhabitants of our particular vantage point in the 21st century, we know this. But the people on the upside of a power dynamic in a relationship, both historically and in the present day, are pretty loath to acknowledge the way in which the power differential in that relationship affects how you can even have feelings.
Yeah, I guess. But I think it undermines her as a villain because it makes her pathetic.
So, but I disagree with that because I think villains should be kind of pathetic. I think that there should be this sense in which the villainy in this person rises up out of some profound and fundamental weakness. And I think that's the essence of making a villain, not just a good villain, but a good character. Okay. Batiatis is a weak man too. Because you notice, is Batiatis ever really doing the dirty work? When he's putting himself in power over other people, is he ever the one who's taking the initiative, putting himself in danger?
No.
In any of that? No. And Luke,
but that doesn't make him weak. That makes him small.
But he's averse to it. Mm. He doesn't accept the danger. He doesn't like that he can only operate from a position of total control. And that's his weakness, right? Is that he doesn't see when he's not actually in control. He's not actually willing to place himself physically at risk for the sake of the gain that he wants. He's willing to put other people at risk for it. That's weakness. That's a moral weakness within his character. Mm. Lucretia's moral weakness is exploiting the system of domination to her ends and not realizing the ways in which that actually cuts her off from genuine feeling and attachment to other people.
I know. I don't feel sorry for her because she's like, she's a monster, but it's more that I felt like it was very like, oh, Lucretia. Everyone like scurries to the chat that she's like not in. Mm-hmm. To be like, did you see Lucretia?
Some of history's greatest monsters were inherently pathetic people.
Yeah, I think, okay, fine. But she's not one of history's greatest monsters.
No,
she sucks.
Yeah, but that's the whole thing, is villainy, to my mind, and evil, true evil, are very rarely the result of the pure psychopaths. Like the dead-eyed, like are incapable of empathy to other people, like budding serial killer types, like which do exist. I coached a kid in soccer who fit this, and he was six, and you could tell, like, oh my God, this kid, lock up the neighborhood pets. Like this boy ain't right. God. These people exist. They are real. They are disproportionately to be found in maximum security prison units. But most people who do terrible things do not fit into that category. They are people who imbibe cultural narratives that they've been told that make it acceptable for them to behave poorly. They make choices out of selfishness that benefit them, and they tell themselves that this is okay or even good. Mm-hmm. That's the nature of evil, to my mind, is these intense moments of weakness, pathetic ideas that metastasize into lashing out or attempting to gain control. Mm-hmm. And the ways in which that happens is what we think of as true evil.
Mm.
That's my take. And so moments.
I think that's a good take, but also I would be in the chat being like, oh, I couldn't even look at her. Does she think that he's in love with her? Oh my God, no, Lucretia. Mm-hmm. We tried to tell her. When she said, do you think Crixus is in love with me? I did say, probably not. But that's not, because that's a him problem. That's
not a you problem. It's problem. Not about you. It's you are great. You're wonderful. Are great.
You are a perfect angel. If Crixus doesn't see that, it's his loss.
Yeah, that's on him.
I did say that. I did say that. And I tried to gently tell her that I didn't think that he was but you know, she still just, she didn't said it in front of everyone. And she like started yelling at his girlfriend. Oh my God. Oh, it's so embarrassing. I felt so bad for her. I would die if that was me. I would die on the spot. I'd like kill myself.
That
like,
is
in public. I'd kill myself in front of everyone.
That is the best impression of the Roman girls group chat that I think I've ever heard. She confessed her love to a slave.
A slave? Can you believe it?
Of her husband.
Like, not even like.
And the legatus.
Person. And the legatus was there and he was like listening and he could like see everything and he's probably going to be prior next year. Oh my God. Oh my God. I was like, just like thinking about like every single one of my household Penates and just being like, the Penates, thank them. That I know how to keep my own counsel because if that was just me, if that was me, I would literally like give one of my slaves a sword and say like, can you just like take my head off? That's what I would just do.
Girl, when I tell you the first thing I did when I went home was offer a sacrifice to Vesta.
Puella,
I am not lying.
Puella. When I tell you, Puella.
This is a good bit. I like
that.
It's
a good bit. I like it. I think we could go on with it. What we probably have to do instead is we probably have to finish the episode because we are running close to time. And I think we've covered like all the main points. Before Navia leaves, she tells Dr. Ori that Barker that Batiatus has had Barker killed because she said like Crixus will start talking about buying his freedom. And Doctor was like, yeah, that'd be great. I will support him. And she's like, no, don't do that because Barker bought his freedom. And then Batiatus, and Doctor is like, oh, he's not allowed to do that though. That's horrid. So that's when you can see the pieces starting to kind of move around for him. And so, yeah, everyone is like taking their places on stage for the big fight.
Oh, this is going to be so much fun. I cannot wait to talk about this next week.
So we're excited. We're excited to talk about the big fight. We will have Milo back next week. We'll have Milo back next week. This has been a bonus.
Yeah, this one's a bonus.
This one has been a bonus one. Thank you very much for being a Patreon subscriber. There is no more that we can ask of you, I don't think.
Yeah.
No, that's it. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You've held up your end of the bargain.
You've held up your end of the bargain. You have done everything we have asked you to. So thank you very much indeed. And
we'll see you next time.
We will see you next time.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.